EMI present the outstanding man of music, the one and only David Bowie, with his hit album, Tonight. I'm gonna write a poem in a letter. Tonight features his current single, plus Blue Jean and seven other great new tracks. Get David Bowie at his best. Get David Bowie tonight.
I was feeling very, very blue. When all of a sudden, she came around the corner. Like, she was the girl and I was the camera. And we were an advert for jeans, like you'd see in the pictures.
Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arsalan Mohammed. And it's a fine feeling indeed to be back with you to bring you the second part of my long and occasionally angry conversation with the one and only Nicholas Pegg, sometime Dalek, and of course the author of The Complete David Bowie. We've been through the first third of the album, we've laughed, we've cried, and yet in this safe space I feel we've made some learnings on our journey through tonight. So, now let's crack on and plunge straight back into the chat as the mighty title track hoves into view. And, oh my god, is that Tina?
So here we are, this is the title track, and of course this is a song that Bowie has direct history with, because he co-wrote it in the first place with Iggy. Unlike, we should perhaps just remind ourselves that, you know, Don't Look Down, the previous one, Bowie had nothing to do with the original version of that. Yeah, that was from Iggy's 79 album, New Values, and it was co-written by Iggy and James Williamson. But this one is a Bowie pop one, and it's from Lust for Life. They actually originally premiered it prior to the Lust for Life sessions, so Bowie had performed it live before on the 1977 Iggy Pop tour, where Bowie played keyboards. That's where they sort of premiered this stuff. Then when they were back in Berlin, they recorded it on Lust for Life. So the original Iggy version has got David on backing vocals and on piano. He's all over it. But yeah, once again here, Bowie does two fundamental changes which completely change the tenor of the song. One is, as we've just said, you know, yet again, we're going white reggae. But more fundamentally than that even, I think, Bowie cuts out the dark opening to Iggy's original version. In Iggy's original version, it begins with Iggy.
I saw my baby. She was turning blue. I knew that soon her young life was through. And so I got down on my knees, down by her bed. Get these are the words. Tell her I said.
Everything will be all right tonight, etc., etc. So she's dying of, we assume, a heroin overdose. This is what the song is about, and it's about her fellow screwed up lover just holding her hand as she slips away into a screwed up death. Now,
it's very cinematic, isn't it?
Which of course brings a whole different complexion to, you know, I'm going to love you till the end. I will love you till we reach the end, which is like, you know, in terminus time.
Which is now. Yes.
Yeah. whereas with Bowie's version, he cuts that and it just becomes, and with the sort of lilting reggae arrangement style, it just becomes a very pretty, heartfelt love song. And I have to say, I think it does it successfully. I don't think this is a travesty. Far from it. I think this sounds very beautiful. And I do, you know, having absolutely given God only knows, poor old God only knows, we've given that a good kicking, I'm going to put this one on my shoulders and carry it around the stadium. I love this one. I think it sounds beautiful. I really, really do. I think it's very surprising, because you wouldn't have thought it would work, but I think it does. It has also has beautiful arrangement, halfway through the full-on marimba solo, as we've mentioned. And of course, it has
I wasn't going to bring up the marimba solo on this, but there's a hell of a lot of marimba going
here. Here's the marimba. And of course, we have Tina. This is what else we have
we
on
have
here.
We have Tina. And okay, so this is a track that you like. I mean, Tina...
I see where this is going.
Yeah. Tina is... I don't know. I feel Tina is somewhat... She doesn't really leap out.
I used to think that, and then I listened to it when in recent years, I thought, oh, I see, I'm not sure it quite works, but I can see what they're doing, or what Bowie's doing, or what someone's idea was. I assume it was David's idea. It sort of develops. Bowie gradually steps aside for Tina during the course of the song. He sings the first verse completely on his own. She's not there. And then in the second verse, there she is, but she's quite low in the mix and just harmonizing.
Yeah.
But then when we get to the third verse, and then the big play out at the end, wham, ladies and gentlemen, Miss Tina Turner, she's big on it. And so I think the idea is that it starts with him and they sort of cross over halfway through and she becomes the star by the end. But I'm not entirely sure that the final mix quite achieves that.
A bit confused about her presence. I just felt she was just underused, and I felt that there would be maybe more interplay between them, or maybe more of a dynamic between them. We have to remember at this point, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, Tina Turner was on the cusp of ginormous success, and she herself credited a large part of that success to David.
That's exactly right. This is really interesting, and it is, as we say, very important contextually to understand exactly where Tina's career was at the moment she stepped into the studio to do her guest spot on Tonight. Her career had been in the doldrums for quite a few years in the tail end of the 70s. You know, she'd been reduced to being just a kind of nostalgia act. But things had started to look up just a few months earlier, at the end of 83. She did this rather marvellous cover version of the Al Green song, Let's Stay Together, which was produced by BEF, the British Electric Foundation, Martin Ware from Heaven 17 and his lot. And that was a decent hit in some places. It was quite a big hit in the UK, went top 10, but it wasn't quite as big a hit in America. And apparently what was happening in 1983 was that her label, Capitol, were kind of wavering about whether she was worth the investment, you know, whether they were going to renew her contract and give her a go with a whole album. Tina herself later related that the person who swung it for her was David Bowie, because he was being schmoozed by a load of record company people around this time, of course. And they said, oh, you know, do you want to come out to dinner, David, or something? And he said, oh, I can't tonight. I'm going to go and see my favorite singer. Why don't you all come with me? Knowing perfectly well that he needed to get them in front of her. And that they would, because David had big cachet on the back of Serious Moonlight. So off they went to see Tina Turner in concert. And it was, according to Tina, that was the turning point. And they went, she's a bit good, isn't she? Okay, here's an album contract. And the result was the Private Dancer album, which had that song on it. It had What Love Got to Do With It on it. It had a cover version, by the way, of David Bowie's song 1984 on it as well. 1984. It was a smash hit, went multi-platinum everywhere, totally relaunched her career, and she became, her sort of imperial phase was launched there. So, you know, Tina was brilliant, and it was Tina's brilliance that made Tina brilliant, but David Bowie was, by all accounts, by Tina's own account, was instrumental in just giving her that little step back onto the platform that she needed at that time. Yeah,
it's a lovely story. It's a fantastic story, and again, a wonderful example of his generosity to other artists, especially other artists who had a rough time or he felt were, you know, being unjustly ignored. I think Tina's story was about to begin a wonderful second act. And Bowie's involvement in that was marvellous. And yeah, Private Dancer, I believe that, yes, Capitol did approve her on the back of that encounter with Bowie. And they only gave her, I think, 2 weeks. It was like, okay, here's some money.
Yes, recorded really quickly. Yeah.
And like you say, yes, it got to number 3 on the Billboard charts, number 2 in the UK, and 5 times platinum in the US, and sold 10 million copies worldwide.
Yeah.
And then in May 84, around the time that they were recording this, she released What's Love Got to Do with It. And do you know who had previously recorded that song?
Oh, yes. No, I do. Who'd, it was someone quite preposterous, isn't it? Oh, gosh, who is it? I mean, I'm sure they're not preposterous, but just the idea of them doing it. Oh, who is it? Who is it? No, you'll have to tell me.
Bucks Fizz.
Bucks Fizz. That's right. It was Bucks Fizz. Yes, I knew it was someone. Look, I love Bucks Fizz. Sorry if you're out there listening, Cheryl. No, love you. Bucks Fizz is wonderful. But yeah, Bucks Fizz did What's Love Got to Do with It. Amazing, isn't it? Apropos of nothing, but it's in my head now, so I'm going to say it. You know Kelly Marie's song, It Feels Like I'm in Love from 1980?
Yes, yes.
Do you know who that was? Because it was written by Ray Dorsett of Mungo Jerry, the guy who wrote In the Summertime.
Mm.
It was originally offered to Elvis Presley towards the end of his life, and he turned it down. But once you hear that, you think, hang on a minute, I can imagine Elvis singing it. My head is in the bin, my feet don't touch the ground. You know, it would work. It would work. But instead, it became this ridiculous kind of, yeah, anyway, there we go.
I'm having trouble imagining a 77 era vintage Elvis. You know, it'd have to be slow down.
It probably would have been extraordinary. But no, Bucks Fizz doing What's Love Got to Do with It. Well,
Bucks
there we
Fizz
go.
Bucks Fizz did What's Love Got to Do with It. Oh, so yeah. Apparently when Tina was in this space where she was obviously so delighted and grateful, and she came in and recorded this. And I think it was Carlos Alomar who said, weirdly, he was very shy around her. He wasn't being particularly like, right, Tina, I want you to do this. I need to do that.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
David, I'd say, like the Young American sessions, but right. More like, whatever you want, Tina.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we've talked about this before. Bowie was genuinely a fan. You know, when the people he admired, and you know, people like Scott Walker and Tina Turner, you know, he was clearly in awe of what she had done. And you know, obviously she'd been up and running earlier than him. She was a wee bit older than him, and she'd been big in the 60s. And you know, so I'm sure he was, you know, genuine. And then when you see that, you know, other than on the Iggy Pop tour, the only time Bowie did do this song live was those two nights at the Birmingham NEC in 1985 on Tina's tour. And he came on as a special guest in the encores when they did it together. It's a beautiful moment because they, you know, when he comes on, the place goes wild. But it goes wild not just for him, but because it's him and her. And he comes down and they dance together. And then at the end of that song, and before they go into Let's Dance, which they do afterwards, Bowie just says this wonderful thing. He sort of takes the microphone and steps forward and says something like, you know, I just want to say what an absolute honor it is to share the stage with Tina. I've admired her for so long, and she's a great artist. And of course, it's Tina's people there, and they go wild for that.
I must say that I've seen Tina so many times over the years, and this is a privilege to be on the same stage as you, Tina.
I've been asking for a long time, and finally I got
it's
it
It's also
here.
The hottest place in the universe.
But he's not just doing it for effect. He really clearly means it. Mm. So it was, you know, and of course they remained musical muckers for a while, didn't they? Because Tina did the Pepsi commercial. Yes. He wrote another song, Girls, that he did as a B-side on the Never Let Me Down session. She recorded a version of it as well. She did a version of Cat People around about this time as well on live, you know, on the Tube, I think it was. I don't mean the London Underground, I mean the programme. So yeah, they stayed very close, and clearly she meant a lot to him. In the Bowie convention in New York that I compared last year, we were, you know, talking about this. We were on stage with Carlos and Robin Clark and Carmine Rojas. So we were talking about these albums that they worked on, and we talked about tonight. They were just so, what? Tina Turner was in the studio. It was such a magical moment. It was an amazing thing. And it is, when you think about it, I mean, she was a legend. And it was already, I assume at that point, already pretty clear that she was, the big comeback was happening. Yes. So this was kind of an exciting moment.
It would have been, wouldn't it? I mean, if they were recording, I don't have the exact dates, but What's Love Got to Do with It came out May. All I have is May. And this was recorded May, June.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
So she's hot as hell. Everyone wants to know her. Everyone wants to know what she's doing. And it must have given a real fillip to the Tonight sessions.
Yeah.
Having her there and people thinking, oh, well, this, you know, so we didn't get off to the best of starts with this album, but here's Tina, here's Energy.
Yeah.
You know, here's, the, you know, the hottest star in the world right now with
David.
With David.
As we said, it was released as a single. It was the second single off the album, but no video. It's before the live performance with Tina. That was a year later. And it did nothing. It did no business, which was the first sign, I suppose, looking back. Things were still very happy and optimistic, and Blue Jean had been a big hit, and this album had gone to number one. But I suppose this is kind of the first sign that all is not well, post-Let's Dance, I suppose, for David, that it didn't do any business at all. But as we've already said, I think that is heavily to do with promotion, because videos were, you just had to have a video in those days. Even if you were David Bowie, you had to have a video because that's how music got anywhere. You know, pubs had started having video jukeboxes, hadn't they? And obviously MTV was the big thing. But yeah, he never did it live again after. Although I think a couple of times on the Sound and Vision tour in 1990, he did this thing with the Gene Genie where he dropped in lines from other songs and he kind of went off scat singing and doing things. And I think he did occasionally pop into a bit of Tonight on that. So that's the only other time he ever did it after that. But yeah, I think it's just lovely. I honestly love this one. You know, it's sweet. It's not edgy. It's not some confrontational or deeply artistic. It's just a sweet, beautiful little love song. And I think it works beautifully. And I really like it. I cannot find it in my heart to say anything bad about it. I think it's lovely.
Well, I won't rain on your parade.
Do you know
that there's something I found out, which is really nice, is that there's a little, tiny little sample from Spanish Harlem by Aretha Franklin, peppered throughout this track. It's like a little string pad. Yeah, so if you listen at 0.49, for example, you'll hear it's like, dun, dun. It's just a small little clip that just goes through.
Well, I have learned something. That's interesting.
Exactly. So not only is he duetting with a legend of soul, he's also tipping his hat to a legend of soul at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, that's good, isn't it? I didn't know that.
It's a nice little detail. Yeah. So, moving on, we have another Iggy Pop original. This is Neighborhood Threat. Yeah.
Now, this is a
Lust for Life.
Again from Us for Life, and again written originally by David and Iggy, also co-written with Ricky Gardner, the guitarist, of course, who played on Low and on Lust for Life, famously co-wrote The Passenger and created that amazing guitar riff for The Passenger, among other things. Played that wonderful guitar solo on Always Crashing in the Same Car. And co-writer on this song. Quite like this one. I'm not saying it's the best thing on the album, but I do quite like it. I think it's worth pointing out, by the way, before we go any further with this song, this is the beginning, in the old money, on vinyl, this is the beginning of side two. Side one ended with Tonight. And with that division, I think you notice that actually that there's a kind of split on the album that I suspect was probably quite deliberate. Nothing like as pronounced as on something like Low, where, you know, the two sides were very conceptual. But nonetheless, side one of Tonight is big on the sort of the wistful ballads and the strings. And side two is more up-tempo and rockier, sort of upping the ante a bit. Dare we even say a little bit edgier. A little bit edgier than the first side. And I assume that was a deliberate decision.
Let's say edgy.
And this is one of Iggy's sort of scary snapshots of urban squalor again, you know, and deprivation. By the way, probably no coincidence that Bowie was kind of moving towards that sort of territory on his next album, Never Let Me Down, you know, and indeed, so probably being influenced by working on these songs on Tonight. You know, a song like Day In, Day Out, for example, is very much cut from the same sort of cloth as Neighborhood Threat, isn't it? Yeah, and again, nice bit of guitar from Carlos on this one, I think. He gets to sort of cut loose a little bit. And Cards on the Table, this has never really, in any version, been one of my favorite ever songs. It's okay. It doesn't really turn me on very much. I do actually... Here comes heresy. I do prefer this version to Iggy's version. This is more polished up and less grungy than Iggy's original and less edgy, if we're going to do edgy again. But for all that, I think it's actually a little bit more sort of hard rocking. And I think Bowie's vocal is actually terrific, really snarling and really fierce. But I think
that's
that might...
That's a hot technique.
It is, I know. And it's probably just me because I don't... You won't find very many people who agree with me on that.
I'm looking at that hill over there and I'm seeing a man... all alone sitting on a hill.
You see, I'm not sure that this is a hill I'm prepared to die on. There are some, I think this one has, you know, kicks a certain amount of ass. But obviously, I Iggy's version is great as well. this is the track that Bowie really disliked and was disappointed with. As early as 1987, not even at Tin Machine time, but on the next album when he was doing interviews for Never Let Me Down, he described this as disastrous. That was the word he used. I've got a bit more of the quote here. What does he say? This is on Neighborhood Threat. Yeah, that's one I wish I'd never touched, or at least touched differently. It went totally wrong. It sounded so tight and compromised. It was the wrong band to do it with. A wonderful band, but it wasn't right for that song. I had this huge bunch of people, and it just made the whole thing claustrophobic, tightened the whole thing up, and it sounds squeaky. Well, I can see what he means there. It has got, it is overmanned. It's got lots of crazy backing vocalists doing funny little ooh bits and things, which is a little bit kind of kitsch and silly. But I think it's quite successful.
I'm in Bowie's side on this. I think it's horrendous. it's to me, it's like one of those sort of John Hughes 1980s Valley High movies where like the bad guys roll into town, like guys on motorbikes,
yeah,
and leather jackets, you know, like,
I like,
you know,
that. Sort of
very, 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 very clean, tough guys.
It would be the backing music as they arrive.
It's the backing music,
yeah.
For some reason, I started thinking of like the Karate Kid or something. And this is the big musical number. You know, even the way it ends, it just all stops. Like everyone's,
yes, yeah, they all freeze in their interpretive dance positions.
Exactly. Yeah. Bowie sounds about as tough as Alan Bennett. I mean, it's just really falls way short of what I think is the scuzziness that is on Lust for Life.
It's, you know, definitely, here, it just, yeah. It's definitely lacking drums, in scuzziness, that's for sure. Yeah,
the popping synths and the, like you mentioned now, the backing vocals. It's just awful. It's absolutely awful. Here, I mean, I don't know what David Bowie had done to Ricky Gardner to upset him so much, but it was seriously something which was a travesty of the original. Just,
Blimey.
The feeble synths, the whiddly rock guitar. I mean, this is... Yeah.
Don't hold back, will you? No. Well, no, this is interesting. Now, I am absolutely aware that my opinion on this one is a bit out there. And it's not that I don't like Iggy's version. I think Iggy's version is indeed scuzzier and grungier, and it needs to be scuzzy and grungy. This, you're dead right. I like your sort of 1980s film analogy. Like, it's something that might be in a sort of, yeah, John Hughes film or something. Yeah. That's exactly right. And it does have that kind of rather slick, rather sort of loathsome sort of 1980s overproduction to it. You're absolutely right. But I do, for, as I say, for all that, I think it delivers a bit of a, packs a bit of a punch, passes a merry moment. But as I said, it's not really a song that does an awful lot for me as a song, to be perfectly honest. I can't get too excited about it. I'm not going to defend it to my dying day in the way that I would with some. But, you know, I don't hate it. You clearly do. That you've made that fairly clear.
I cannot tell a lie. I tried. I mean, Nick, you have to be aware that I haven't done an episode of this podcast for a long time. So I came really bright-eyed and bushy-tailed to this, the first recording, despite the technical issues we've had today, despite the fact we both have colds, despite all these things. I was prepared to come here and be sunny, optimistic, positive Arslan. And then we talk about Neighborhood Threat.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's far from being my favorite track on this album. If I had to start dropping songs from this album, I think we already know which one would be first. Yes. We were there a while ago. But this might kind of just about be the second. Or it certainly might be the next contender. But, you know, I don't hate it. But I just, yeah.
Shall we talk about Hugh Padgham's least favourite song on tonight?
This will be the next one, won't it?
This will be the next one. This was Hugh Padgham's least favorite.
Yes,
just
this is extraordinary.
Take a moment to think about that.
That is remarkable, I think, because
he found it lightweight.
Yes, he thought, well, I mean, it kind of is lightweight, but I don't think it matters. We are, of course, talking about the next track, the first single, the big hit, Blue Jean.
Blue Jean, I just
Hugh Padgham didn't like it at all, did he? He thought it was beneath David's talents and everything. Yeah. I don't really think that. It's not obviously the most sort of layered and substantial song that Bowie ever, of course
it's not the Bewley Brothers, is it?
No, it's the Bewley Brothers, it ain't. but you see, I would argue that while Loving the Alien is the most substantial piece of songwriting on this album, I think taken in the round, Blue Jean is the most successful track. Yes. You know, it's not high art, but it's a terrific pop song and it just works. You know, it's the one point on this album where the production and, you know, everything that on other tracks don't necessarily serve songs terribly well, they just come together and work really well on this track.
Absolutely.
And it's not unsophisticated. You know, as ever with Bowie, there are some unexpected chord changes and strange little tricksy rhythmic devices and some lovely vocal harmonies that he's doing. He was a master of building up his own voice in harmonies, and there are some really strange ones on this that perhaps familiarity means that we don't hear them as much, really. So I think it is actually quite a clever song. But essentially it is an old-fashioned pop number in that sort of 1950s Eddie Cochran style, you know, very much harking back to the anecdote that Bowie told regarding the previous album, Let's Dance, which is, you know, just before recording Let's Dance, he got out all these old rock and roll and R&B songs from that he'd liked as a boy and listened to them again. And that's what kind of charged him up for the sort of energy of Let's Dance. And this is that kind of thing. I mean, he himself said the great quote, which I'm sure people know anyway, but he described this song as a piece of sexist rock and roll about picking up birds. It's not very cerebral. That's what he said. And, you know, he's right. But I think it's a great pop song. It's you know, as you say, it's not the Bewley Brothers. It's not the Width of a Circle. It's not Sweet Thing, but it's just a good, honest, down the line, nice bit of pop music. Works very well. And of course, it was a hit. It was the lead-off single. It went to number six in Britain, and it went to number eight in America, which is actually in some ways a more significant achievement, because his commercial strikes in America came and went far more quickly than they did in Britain, and he was still holding firm there in America on the back of, you know, Let's Dance, and this song did very well. And of course, one of the reasons it did very well is the famous video, which we will probably have to talk about at some length.
We will definitely get to the video, but yeah. I completely agree with you. And it's just to touch again on what we discussed about Arif Mardin earlier. My idea of Arif Mardin as a producer, here it all seems to work. This is how I imagine Arif Mardin would have done a job like this, where he organizes the vast array of instrumentation, effects, production techniques, and so on into a really wonderfully cohesive whole. I think a lot of my problems with the other tracks on this album is the production is all over the place, the arrangements are just nuts, and they don't serve the song as well as they could. Whereas here, I mean, it's not, you know, you factor in the ephemeral sounds, the marimbas and the parping synths and the backing vocals, everything that's very much ephemeral of its time. But here, I think it's been organized and structured beautifully. And like you say, it, you know, it's one of those things where a hell of a lot of work has gone into creating something very simple and straightforward. So the song has a wonderful energy, big sing-along chorus. I think for everybody expecting Mr. Let's Dance to come back with his next album, his new project, this was a fantastic sign. Here he is, you know. Also, what I like about this is that there is a very Bowie-esque twist here. Reminding me of tracks like Janine, for example, where you have Blue Jean here, and he's kind of painting a girl's character in broad strokes. You know, she's got this, she's got that, she's that, she's that, and that's it. That's the sum total of the lyric, you know, and that's all it needs to be.
And the things that she's got are so scattered. Random. And what she's got a police bike, she's got a turned up nose, she's got Latin roots. It's a weird lyric because it's not profound, but it's in its own funny way, in its own funny sort of impressionistic way. It's very Bowie.
It's very Bowie, isn't it? I mean, driving a Beetle car or something.
That's right. That. And of course, the Gene Genie one thinks of, because Blue Gene Genie.
Yes.
And in the Gene Genie, similarly, we have all these kind of nonsensical images that go together to create something. You know, ate all the razors while pulling the waders, talking about Munro. Yeah. But, you know, it's kind of almost quite similar, isn't it, to the...
She's pretty much in that mold, isn't it? Well, you mentioned just now the big selling point around this song, which was the video. And it makes it even more remarkable that he didn't do a proper video for Tonight, given the fact that this was a huge, huge deal. In fact, I've been watching Jazzing for Blue Jean a few times over the last couple of weeks, and it's so much fun, and it's so enjoyable. And I think did it win a Grammy?
Yes, it probably did. I'm terrible on awards. I can never remember anything. Yes, I think it did. I mean, it should have done, shouldn't it? It's also, as I'll probably mention in a minute, you know, I think it plumbs into quite a lot of David Bowie's deep-seated ideas about his art in a almost quite serious way, but in the form of, and through the medium of, a goofy screwball comedy that's 20 minutes long. It's really, it doesn't outstay its welcome. That's a good thing, you know, because it is, you know, the long-form pop video with a bit of acting and some scenes, of course, was suddenly all the rage because Michael Jackson had set the bar with Thriller the year before, so everyone wanted a piece of that. And of course, David Bowie was pretty quick off the mark to do one, and who can blame him?
I was trying to think who else did similar things. So obviously Thriller, then there's this.
Yes. Well, I'd say Bowie was one of the first people to jump on, we're calling it a bandwagon, aren't it? To do this rather obvious thing once it had become a thing. The Pet Shop Boys did one not too long afterwards, about 3 years after that, they did whatever that funny, strange short film of theirs was called. I mean, that's a little bit later, of course. The Rolling Stones did their Undercover of the Night. Where the Rolling Stones briefly re-enter Bowie's story because, as we know, there had been this on and off sort of tit for tat stealing things from each other thing with Mick Jagger going back way back to the 70s. And at this point, whilst Mick Jagger phoned up Nile Rodgers to produce his new solo album at around about this time, David Bowie got in touch with the hotshot young video director who had just shot the Rolling Stones Undercover of the Night. So a new and important collaborator for David Bowie, the great Julian Temple, enters the story.
Yes.
Now, Julian Temple had cut his teeth working back in the 70s with the Sex Pistols. He'd followed them around with the Super 8 cameras and things, and he had ended up directing, he directed the great Sid Vicious
rock
video. He directed the great Rock and Roll Swindle as well, of course. And he directed Sid Vicious's video for My Way, you know, that thing. And then he went on to become a much in demand video director. He'd already, you know, made his name quite substantially by now. He'd worked with the Undertones. He did the My Perfect Cousin, and he did Culture Club's Do You Really Want to Hurt Me? He did Poison Arrow for ABC. That was a famous video. And he directed the video of the biggest selling single of 1982, Come On Eileen by Dexys Midnight Runners. So he, and all sorts of other things. And he'd worked with the Stones. So anyway, Bowie gets in touch with Julian Temple and says, I've got this idea for not just a video, the video will be in it, but it will be embedded within this thing I want to make. And this little comedy film about a boy and a girl and a rock star. Now, there's so much to say about this film, because I love this. I love this film. I think it's one of his great acting roles, apart from anything else. He really proves himself to be a genuinely talented comic actor. So where should we start? I mean, can we start actually with Anthony Newley?
I think that's a very good point, because I think in everything to do with this 21 minute short, we are going back into a wonderful, rich British music hall tradition here.
We absolutely
comedy
are.
Pratfalls.
The Newley thing, I mean, we all know about David and Anthony Newley and how much he enjoyed him and how much he sort of based some of his early vocal stylings on him and things. But he often, Bowie, mentioned The Strange World of Gurney Slade, which was a wonderfully peculiar, surreal, sort of pre-psychedelic, meta, way ahead of its time comedy series that went out in 1960. It's in black and white. It's out on Blu-ray, and it's absolutely worth seeing, honestly, if you still do physical media. But it's an amazing piece of work. It's utterly strange.
A half-hour television show. Half an hour to put the world right. What can you do in half an hour? I need at least 40 minutes. And I can do without that lot back there as well. How would you like your egg done, dear? The golden years of British entertainment. So much for Shakespeare and Sophocles. I prithee, husband, I will not trouble thee, my love, beyond thine intelligence, to what degree of hardness thou requirest in thine egg. Act 4, Scene 2, Omelette the Prince. How would you like your egg done, dear? And that neighbour. People just don't have neighbours like that. They're the sort of people you see walking past here. They're all potential neighbours. Take him, for instance. He could be my neighbour.
Among other things, in Strange World of Gurney Slade, what happens is Anthony Newley kind of narrates it as if he's aware that he's in a TV show and directing his own life. And sure enough, what do we have right at the beginning of Jazzing for Blue Jean? We have Bowie up a ladder, pasting up the poster on the wall of the rock star, and he sees the beautiful girl walking down the street, and he starts in voiceover imagining himself as the camera. He says, dead trendy, a long shot down the street from a high POV because I was up on the ladder. And that is exactly what it's like in The Strange World of Gurney Slade.
I was feeling very, very blue. when all of a sudden, she came around the corner. Like, she was the girl and I was the camera, and we were an advert for jeans, like you'd see in the pictures. Dead trendy, like. A long shot down the street from an odd POV, because I was on my ladder.
Anyway, do you want to come and meet this concert or what?
Of course I do, you know I do.
And I thought, she could be mine, this dream.
Don't walk in that gutter. So rude.
Well, I'm not walking under there. I've had enough bad luck already.
Oh, don't be dumb.
Well, you walk under there, you watch. Your best friend will be run over by a bus. Here you go, love.
Ta very much.
Yeah.
She spoke to me, and that was it. I fell.
And also, the very first scene of The Strange World of Gurney Sade at the start of the first episode, it's like six episodes or something, is Anthony Newley in a kind of hyper-realist kitchen sink drama scene with a suburban family, you know, just like a totally ordinary sort of soap opera, so Coronation Street or something. And they're just sitting around the dining table, this family sort of bickering. And then as it goes on, Anthony Newley just turns and looks at the camera with a kind of existential despair in his face. And then he just gets up, ignoring the rest of the cast who carry on talking, and just walks towards the camera, and the camera pulls back, and he just keeps on walking until you can see the studio and the crew and the cameras and the cables, and he just keeps on walking, and the camera follows him, and he walks out of the studio, out of the building, out onto the street outside, leaving all of that behind. And that's like the beginning of the show, the beginning of his strange adventure into the... And of course, that's exactly what Bowie does at the end of Jazzy for Blue Jean. It's the very same gag. The camera pulls out, and he starts squabbling with Julian Temple, who appears in it, and you see all the crew with their boom mics and everything, and they start squabbling about the ending of the film. And it's pure Anthony Newley, straight from that old show that grabbed his attention as a young boy back in 1960, when he'd have only been 12 or 13 years old, something like that.
Car stops. Girl gets out. Hold on, Julian.
What?
The car's meant to stop. Girl gets out, runs over to me. Boy meets girl.
I think she's carried the legend.
I've been thinking. What?
Thinking.
Look, it's my song, my concept, my neck. I told you before, Julian, if she gets into the car with a rock star, it's far too obvious. Don't you start.
And by the way, he also starts the Loving the Alien video, which was the following year, which was David Mallet, not Julian Temple directed, with a kind of equal but opposite thing. The beginning of the Loving the Alien video starts with a kind of studio reveal. You see all the cameras and things.
Yes.
And then it pushes in onto the set and the cameras and cables disappear. And we enter the sort of the fiction of the Loving the Alien video, whatever you want to call it. So that's a really important thing, I think, to just see that this is Bowie, just as he so often did, picking up on something from his youth that he really liked and doing something with it and, you know, turning it to his own use. And as I kind of mentioned a moment ago, I think another really important thing about Jazz Infamy, another point of interest anyway, is that it very clearly revives one of his abiding preoccupations, which is the deeply peculiar nature of the relationship between celebrities and pop stars in particular, and, for want of a better word, normal people like you and me, you know, the rest of us. And we've already at this point seen him dabbling in this sort of thing. If you think about the video for Fashion from a few years earlier, there's Bowie as the star on stage and as the fan in the audience looking up at him and doing what he says, listen to me, don't listen to me, talk to me. So they did that a little bit after this on the Glass Spider tour in 87. There's that marvelous trick routine where they pull a screaming fan out of the audience near the beginning of the show to dance with David, as per the Bruce Springsteen video and as per Bono at Live Aid, who did it in real life. But then she suddenly, as he starts sort of dancing with her and she starts groping her, and then she pulls back and slaps him in the face. And you realize that she's, of course, a plant and she's one of the dancers. And then at the end of that song, they have a bit of dialogue before the next song, where one of the other dancers actually says, if you watch the video, they say, we can't have rock stars cross-breeding with normal people. And then once again, many years later, that same fascination surfaces again in that extraordinary video and song, The Stars Are Out Tonight, which has these sort of doppelganger celebrities sucking the life out of normal people in some kind of weird horror film situation. So Exhibit A in all of this is surely Jazzin' for Blue Jean, this extraordinary comedy film about the distance between the fan and the celebrity and the person who isn't a fan, who doesn't understand the attraction of the celebrity. So he plays this sort of Jack the Lad called Vic, and he also plays Screaming Lord Byron. Screaming Lord Byron.
I love the rock star, the depiction of the rock star as this sort of vaguely oriental figure. I mean, yes. when you see him, he's appearing at the Bosphorus Rooms.
That's right, the Bosphorus Rooms. What
and
a brilliant.
He's got these baggy, what do you call them?
Harem trousers.
Harem trousers. And the makeup and everything. I mean, he's this, you know, comically exotic character.
That's right. And it is on one level, for the purposes of the video, you know, the bit where he just does the song. It is actually beautiful. I mean, it's beautiful, a beautiful costume, and designed by a designer called Alison Chitty, by the way, who worked at the National Theatre. And the makeup, I mean, and of course, this is Bowie after the comparatively sort of normalized Serious Moonlight period, where, you know, yeah, he dyed his hair blonde, but apart from that, he was just this guy in a suit. Yeah. This is David Bowie suddenly dripping with makeup and crazy costumes and wearing a turban and doing a bonkers dance routine for the first time in many, many a long year, isn't it? You know, so that's interesting. So he projects this exotic, ridiculous rock star image, which is sort of worshipped by the, even before we get to the bit where they go to the Bosphorus Rooms and go to the concert, when he first starts trying to chat up the girl in the pub and Blue Jean, Screaming Lord Byron comes on the video, because again, we have got a video jukebox in that pub, you know. You see behind him, while he's trying to chat the girl up, behind him, all the people are watching the video and they're all enthralled to it and doing these strange moves that go with the video and clicking their fingers. And it's this thing, this hypnotic effect that the rock star has on the flock. It's ridiculous and funny, but it's actually quite sinister as well.
I had to rewind that a few times just to try, because I saw it on YouTube, and it is all there on YouTube, but it's a very low res version that I saw on YouTube, so occasionally it is quite blurry and hard to tell what's going on. Obviously, if you haven't seen this yet, then pause right now, go and watch it, come back here in 20 minutes and we'll still be talking about it. It makes much more sense obviously if you've seen it.
And if you do still do physical media like I do, because I like to have the thing in my hot little hand, if you have the Easter Best Eggs of Bowie DVD collection from many years ago, it's on there. There's an Easter egg. Yes, you have to go to Blue Jean, and then I forget, you have to sort of swipe right or something, and another little icon appears and you click on that. But anyway, it's on there, the whole full-length 21-minute thing. It is interesting that, that he's doing this. And of course, this crazy pop star, as I say, you know, for the purposes of the actual performance of the song, he looks great, and it's a great, and he dances, he moves beautifully, and it's great. It's very impressive, chic MTV age video. But the stuff that surrounds it is what gives it its, you know, because offstage, backstage, Screaming Lord Byron is revealed to be this brittle, anaesthetized, pill guzzling.
And listening to Varzawa.
Absolutely.
Got you. Mr. Screaming, good evening. I'm from the Melody Faces. No, one of the music magazines. I was with a music magazine. I'm with a more high-profile kind of... I've really hurt my head.
Those backstage shots of him, looking in the mirror, a bit handheld, doing his makeup, they actually look uncannily like, and I can't quite believe this was coincidental.
That's exactly what I thought.
The backstage footage from the 1973 Pennebaker film of the Hammersmith Odeon. You know, and it, obviously this is getting quite close to the bone for Bowie to be doing this kind of, you know, rock superstar who behind the scenes is a deeply insecure screw up. And there are bits in it, comedy bits, because let's not forget it's funny. It is funny. That's what it's for. But there are bits in it. When he's talking to the bouncer and desperately trying to get past the bouncer, there's a bit where he says, I caught that tour in Berlin. I thought they tricked it up with a bit too many lights and special effects. And you know, that's David Bowie taking the piss out of himself, isn't it? As is the final bit where the lovey rock star steals the girl and walks off with her. And so Bowie, as Vic, rushes out into the street.
I'm speechless. You can Ivan Randy Bogus, Oriental Old Queen. Your record sleeves are better than your songs.
Exactly. And again, that's kind of, you know, that could be someone who doesn't particularly like David Bowie talking about David Bowie, couldn't it? I mean, and he knows it. He knows that perfectly well. It's very funny, but he is actually pointing out some stuff, isn't he? And you know, all sorts of bits of 1984 ephemera are sort of grist to the mill of this thing. There's a bit where he's trying on different clothes to wear for his date, and he can't decide what to wear. And there's a bit where he tries on a Frankie you know, Frankie Say t-shirts were the big thing that summer, and he puts one on, and he's all in voiceover again, and he says something like, Frankie says, relax, that's definitely I'm not going to wear that until they tell us who Frankie is. He, at the time, in some interview, he said, oh, I hate those t-shirts, I really hate them, I wanted to put it. This is interesting because Frankie Say, you know, that whole campaign or whatever you want to call it, was devised, of course, by Paul Morley, who at the time was working as their sort of PA or whatever it was. So, you know, Frankie Say relax, Frankie Say do this, Frankie Say that. That was his kind of shtick. And fast forward 30 odd years, and it was Paul Morley who gave the V&A the notion of calling their exhibition David Bowie Is. And David Bowie Is This, David Bowie Is That.
Morley.
You know, they put different things on it. That was Paul Morley's suggestion. It was indeed. He devised that thing. And it's kind of the same thing as Frankie Say, isn't it? Yeah. So hopefully David didn't hate it
That's
as much.
That's a great little fact. I mean, so Paul Morley came up with that whole David Bowie Is strapline, which is such a wonderful way just to take you into that world.
And you could put whatever you wanted on the end of it, but it worked as its own thing, just David Bowie Is. But then they could put David Bowie Is Here on the posters or whatever it was. But also, you know, they had wonderful,
merch
at that exhibition. You know, that you could buy a pencil. You could buy a pencil with David Bowie Is graphically yours.
It's a great example of the humour in Jazz In For Blue Jean. You know, it's kind of close to the edge. I mean, to diss Frankie in summer 1984 or September 1984, was quite a bold move. That's a bold move.
Well, yeah. That's bold, actually. Frankie Goes to Hollywood was the sensation of the year. Oh, yeah. They were massive Bowie fans, weren't they? All of them. And yeah, indeed, yeah. So, so yes, it was a bit fearless, actually. And it is funny.
The wonderful Eve Ferret.
We must, of course, mention the wonderful Eve Ferret, who plays the girl with the guest list. That brilliant scene where Bowie's trying to peer over and see what the names are and claim that he's one of them. And he can't. And she gets wise to it and starts pulling the paper back so he can't see it. He's going, whoosh, Ollie.
Yogi.
It's just bonkers. It's absolutely brilliant.
What is your name?
Yogi. Oleander. Whoosh Oleander.
Whoosh Oleander.
Whoosh
Oleander. You're so now a two ticket, please.
Yeah. How are you,
that's me.
Oh, yeah. You're a bit thinner this time, aren't you? Demis Roussos on your bike, son.
Yeah.
I've got more trivia. No, sorry, I just remembered another piece of trivia which we must do is that the band playing with Screaming Lord Byron in the Bosphorus Rooms, they're not the real band. It's not Carlos and Co. It's just some. They are musicians, but they were just local London musicians who happened to be available to mime for the shoot. And the bass player is the then unknown. He was in some band or other, but the then unknown Richard Fairbrass, later to be of Right Said Fred, and later than that to be not someone we particularly want to talk about. But anyway, but there he is. There he is in that. And
I found this quote from Julian Temple talking about his first encounter with Bowie. I was expecting the man who fell to earth, someone otherworldly. What I got was Cheeky Dave. The first meeting was rather disorientated, although intellectually we clicked. And then, you know, we collaborated on what would be this 20-minute film. And he was an absolute delight to work with. We even came up with the ending on the spot when we'd run out of time and money by feigning an argument and by breaking the fourth wall, by having him yelling at me, actor to director. He was very collaborative and very keen that you got your point across. I think he felt that he was the casting director, and if he'd cast you properly, then he should just let you get on and do it. He wouldn't micromanage. If you watch that film now, I still maintain that the ordinary version of himself that he plays in the film is the closest approximation of what David was actually like. It's the nearest thing to the real David Bowie that's ever appeared on screen.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And that's someone who knew, because he got to know David really well over that year. And of course, not long after David appeared in Absolute Beginners, again directed by Julian Temple, so they were very close at that time and they got to know each other. I suppose we like to think of David Bowie as this super cool person who didn't have any sort of hang-ups and just kind of breezed in and knew exactly what was going on, but of course we also know from multiple sources and from listening to him talk in interviews that he was a very sensitive person, and he was sometimes quite an insecure person.
It's a wonderful example of Bowie sort of sending up his own neuroses and insecurities, isn't it, in the character of Vic? I mean, when you watch Vic, you immediately, you know, he's this sort of like 1950s sort of spiv character. He's affecting that very, again, you bring back Anthony Newley. He exaggerates the Anthony Newley Cockney voice. You know, he's a real wide boy and he's ridiculous. He's ridiculous as well, but you're rooting for him. He's very lovable, and there's that wonderful sequence that you...
Oh, he's very lovable.
He's repeatedly trying to get into a club. to see. He's got a date with this girl, and he's trying to get into the club. He hasn't got a ticket, and he's repeatedly coming up against this big beefy bouncer who won't let him in. And then you can imagine all the pratfalls. You know, he's being thrown on the cobblestones, and then he tries to climb in here, and then he tries to do that, and then you wish there'd been more this Bowie on film. Maybe it was just something that he could summon for this short thing. Something that really, really struck me watching this is how much fun he's having and how much creativity and presence of Bowie was there. You could sense that he'd been throwing lots of ideas in. In contrast with the album, which, like we've been saying, wasn't his most committed creative effort. It seemed that his creative energies were so apparent on this video.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Exactly that. It's as though, you know, okay, this is the material that we've got to work with. Now, how are we going to make this brilliant? Let's do this amazing film. And it kind of works, doesn't it? And such a good physical performance, as well as, you know, his delivery is very good and the character that he creates. But just his physical skill, I mean, we know this anyway from his dancing and his moves on stage and things, that he was such an extraordinary physical performer. I love the bit, because of course it culminates in the video, the performance of Blue Jean, with Byron on stage but Bowie as Vic sitting at the table with, and there's a fantastic bit, the timing is, I mean, it's exquisite comic timing, where Bowie looks in one direction, Vic looks in one direction, puts his fingers as in bring me some champagne, and at exactly that moment a bottle of champagne arrives from the other direction. It had nothing to do with him, and he turns around and looks at it, and he just looks down at the champagne and then looks up at the person who brought it, and it's just it is so good. It is perfect comic timing. And then there's another lovely bit when he's just after he's changed into what he's going to wear, that sequence of what's he going to wear. He lives in this sort of strange odd couple flat with his cool flatmate, doesn't he, where there's a strip along the floor that his side is all messy and the other guy's side is all clean. It's just like, it's this weird thing. But anyway, so he ends up wearing his flatmate's clothes, which means that they don't fit perfectly well. And that cuts to a shot of him running down these steps, and with such grace and agility, he does this comic gag that he runs down the steps and one of the shoes comes off because it's a bit too big, and he runs back up the steps and puts his foot in it and then runs down again. It's so beautifully done.
The thing that shines through this is how much fun everyone is having, to the point that you said at the end where there is that wonderful final scene. That isn't meant to happen. The rock star's not meant to get the girl. I'm meant to, you know, and it's just brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Temple is saying that. It was something that was more or less devised on the spot. Yeah. You just mentioned now his flatmate. So in the film, there's his flatmate. Does he do a little bit of coke at one point? Isn't there a scene where he's doing something a bit suspicious out of a bottle?
The flatmate? Oh, is there? Isn't he just trimming his nostril hairs or something? You might be right. I've always took it that he's trimming his nostril hairs, but you could be right. Maybe I'm just too innocent.
I was just trimming my nostril hairs, officer.
Maybe he is. I
thought it was just a really weird thing to put in.
That would be... maybe in the atmosphere of that time and of sort of MTV and blah blah, that would be quite a saucy thing to put in.
One last thing about Spencer, the flatmate. He was played by an actor called Graham Rogers. And do you know who Graham Rogers was married to?
Mm-hmm.
No. No idea. Okay, I'll put all the audience out of their misery. He was married to Twinkle, the pop star of Golden Lights fame.
Twinkle, the small world. Well. Again, you've mind blown. I can't think of anything to say.
What's the name of the love interest? So that's the actress.
Louise Scott is the name of the actress, I think, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know if...
The Dream.
Does she ever get named? So the Dream's original
boyfriend. She's my Dream. Was a chap, the one who we see at the beginning of the video walking along, is a chap called Chris Sullivan.
Yes.
And he was at the time a DJ, and he launched the Wag Club, which was the Soho night spot at the time, a favourite of Bowie's. And he said when we launched, he started popping in a lot with Julian Temple, and he loved Soho. He loved seeing what was going on. He was soaking everything up. Anyway, I was at home one day, and I was asked, would I like to be an extra in Jazzin' for Blue Jean? And when I turned up at 6 o'clock on the day of the shooting, they handed me a piece of paper and said, these are your lines. And let me tell you, those weren't the kind of lines I needed at 6 a.m. Ha! There we go. But he's... Yeah.
No, that is an interesting connection, because performance scene in Jazzin' for Blue Jean was not shot at the Wag Club. That was shot at the Rainbow Room in Kensington, which was a kind of very strange sort of deco, rather glorious place. But there is, of course, a second video for Blue Jean that was shot just a few days later by Julian Temple with the same band miming and the same extras, largely. And that was shot at the WAG Club. And this was done for the MTV, the American MTV Awards, to be shown there. So, but it was quite elaborate. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, standing on a stage sort of doing, you know, it's a whole kind of routine. And it's quite good, actually. Again, that can be found as an Easter egg on the DVD, and it's probably up on YouTube and things. But worth a look, actually, because Bowie, again, is really, you know, performing with great grace. He's really giving it his all. It's quite a nice, you know, it's like a little alternative, far less elaborate sort of stand and deliver sort of video, but it's
a
nice.
Very,
it's
really very nice. Alarmingly,
alarmingly naff 1980s clothes, but rather reminiscent of the, well, sort of pre-reminiscent of the thing he wears in Dancing in the Street with Mick Jagger a few months later. It's kind of that sort of jumpsuit thing, but he's got a different sort of jacket over the top of it. And the other interesting thing about that one is that they took the decision to sort of mix in the voices. They got the crowd to sing the chorus, the whole human race, that bit. And they're all singing it, and they kind of mix that into the track, and it doesn't actually make it sound any better. It just vaguely makes it sound a bit like it's live. And it's not live, of course.
Because, it's got a great bounce and zip and energy to it. I think that's probably just the general vibe and the mood in the club. And it just seems such a positive, wild, fun event.
Yes. Yes, no, absolutely. It is really nice. It's a really nice thing. And again, indicative of the fact that he was really pushing, you know, the publicity campaign for this album and this single particularly was quite sort of elaborate, really, wasn't it? This song carries with it this rather good sort of baggage of this wonderful long form video. Of course, it was a song that survived along with Loving the Alien more than any of the others in his live career. He played it on the Glass Spider tour, and he played it again on the Sound and Vision tour, and I think it did pop up the reality tour among the many extraordinary things about it, because that was the biggest tour of his career. That outstripped the Serious Moonlight and all the others. It went on and on even before it was curtailed. It had already become the longest one that he'd ever done. And one of the extraordinary things about it was that, you know, to keep himself from getting too bored, they rehearsed an extraordinary number of songs. And then he chose the set list, and they stuck to the core ones were always in the set list, of course, but he chopped and changed and dropped in other ones and put in a new one. Yeah. And Blue Jean was one of the ones that he occasionally did for fun, you know, because it's a fun song.
And that was part two of my king-size chat with Nick Pegg. And if you enjoyed it, I'll have part three heading your way very soon. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and thanks for being in touch with me to argue your views on the first part of the podcast. I'm really glad to see that God Only Knows has aroused such stout defence from many of you in particular. But anyway, I'll be back soon with some more. Thanks again, and bye for now.
I'm speechless.
I'm speechless. You can Ivan Randy Bogus Oriental Old Queen. Your record sleeves are better than your songs. Car stops. Go get some.